Hello, and welcome to Endeavors. Please enjoy these interviews with Booker T. Jones, Nylon's Claude Morrison, and Blue Rodeo's Greg Keeler. I'm joined on the phone by Booker T. Jones. Booker, hello. Welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here, Dan. Thank you for having me.
So, the most latest album you released is Sound the Alarm. What can you tell us about how that album came about for you?
It's a culmination of various younger people I've met who were involved in and infatuated with the soul sound that I had to do with in the early 60s, and of course they call it neo-soul. People like Sharon Jones and Gary Clark Jr., Maya Hawthorne, who do R&B and soul music. And I had occasion to meet a lot of those people over my travels. And so I stayed in touch and invited them to work with me.
And I read that with this album, you returned to Stax Records. What went into that decision? Why go back to Stax?
I had spent a good bit of my career at that time on Anti Records, and Stax had actually been courting me, but you know, I wasn't completely aware that it was a completely new label, which it is. And, of course, I parted with, on not the best terms, with the original Stax Records in 1969. So.
you mentioned you talked about the neo-soul sound, and it seems like soul is undergoing a bit of a revival at the moment. And you know, in the last few years, we've had people kind of like, you know, Joss Stone, Amy, Adele, even people like Tia, you know, Bradza could be classified as soul. What do you make of the fact that we're sort of seeing this new movement of an old sound?
Well, it's a genre that hopefully will be around for a long time. It's based on, you know, R&B blues that started in the 60s, and I don't know, people like Daryl Hall and Hall and Oates and a lot of the older soul acts are still around, and the younger acts are working with the older acts now, and it's just great music, actually, you know, great songs, and it's great to see it reviving.
Of course, you made your name way back in 1962 with Green Onions. What was it like for you becoming that well known when you were still that young?
It was amazing. It was a big surprise to hear the record on the radio. It was just something that I loved to do, a little bit more than a hobby. I was going to college to learn to be a music teacher. Big surprise.
You know, what do you make of the state of music and the industry today versus back when you started?
I think the state of the industry is good. It's harder to get a break now than it was when I started. It was hard then, but I think because there are no small record labels that are taking young musicians in and supporting them as they develop, like it was back then.
And of course, I know you know, because of all your work, you were recently given a Lifetime Achievement Award Grammy. And of course, all awards and all Grammy awards are special. But did the Lifetime Achievement Award hold a different kind of significance for you?
Yes, it was especially gratifying, Dan, because it came from people who do what I do, who have done what I've done, my peers, and it just meant so much to me that, you know, that my life was being paid tribute to like that.
Now, one lovely thing about Sound the Alarm is all the different artists that featured on the album. You've got the Avila Brothers, Usher, Janet Jackson, Mary J. Blige, Missy Elliott, Chaka Khan, Earth, Wind, and Fire. Were these people that you sought out? Did they come to you? Was it the label? How did these collaborations come to fruition?
Well, just over my career, I've been to the Grammy Awards four times. For instance, I met Anthony Hamilton three times at the Grammy Awards, standing in line waiting for food. And I met Maya Hawthorne through my friend Daryl Hall in New York when I played his TV show. It's just, you know, the places that I frequented have been ripped with great talent. I met Gary Clark Jr. in Cupertino, California at Apple at an audition up there. And so we just exchanged numbers and stayed in touch. And that's how it's worked out.
And I got to ask you, of course, the album before Sound the Alarm you made with one of my favorite bands, The Roots. Where did that come from? That seems like a very... Maybe not a collaboration that people might expect, but I think one that works out very, very well.
That was Jimmy Fallon's idea. Jimmy invited me to his show and suggested that we do walk-ons together. And Jimmy's a musician himself, and he's really an entrepreneur, and it worked out well. He put us together.
What would you say today to perhaps a young person who is trying to break into the industry? What piece of advice would you give them?
I would say to concentrate on your own uniqueness and realize that there's no one else making music like you. Each person is unique, and I think that was my strength, and that will be the strength for someone getting started in the business today.
And what was it like for you to have your son play with you on the final track on the album?
It was great. You know, he had been a soccer player for many years, and then I wasn't expecting him to go into music, and then I heard a guitar coming from my family room one day, and I had played some shows with Joe Bonamassa, and it reminded me of Joe Bonamassa, so I thought Joe was on the big TV there in the family room. The TV was off, and it was my son sitting in there playing with his amp, and that's when I realized he was really a talented musician, so I invited him into the band. It's just great doing things with him. We have been looking for things to do together anyway.
Is he now going to be a full-time musician like yourself?
Yes, he's coming with me. He's coming with me to Vancouver. That's his passion.
That must hold a personal point of pride for you, not only being able to have your son with you on the album, but also traveling around with him. What does that do for, I guess, the father-son bond, if you want to call it that?
It does, because he does things on the road an average sideman wouldn't do. He looks after me, you know, and Pop. So if I leave something in the dressing room, you know, I don't have to. I got it for you, Dad. You know, he does that on stage. He just watches after me. It's really nice.
So what do you like most about touring? I mean, does it get different every time you do it?
Well, I get to play some of my favorite music. You know, I still love my songs that I recorded with Booker T and the MGs, Green Onions, Time Is Tight, Hip Hugger, Soul Limbo. And now that I've been touring for a long time, I see people that I know, people that have been coming to the shows for years, and they bring their kids, and it's not quite a family affair, but it's rewarding.
One thing, you mentioned Green Onions a couple of times, and one thing I really like about that song is that I think the simplicity, like, it proves that you don't have to have many layers and all that kind of stuff to have a hit song, a hit record. What was the impetus for you writing it? Do you remember that process?
Yeah, I was in a music theory class, and I left the normal scale that my teacher was teaching me, and I changed the major third to a minor third in my chord progressions, and that's what kind of got me started on the minor third there in Green Onions for the second chord, and just a unique sound.
Do you have any theories as to why it became such the massive hit that it did?
It's a 12-bar blues, and, you know, in Memphis in those days, a lot of the songs that we played were 12-bar blues. I had a very special drummer and guitar player and bass player on the song, and it was just a special moment. Maybe it was a lot of luck, I'm not sure.
And it's interesting to me that it's kind of stood the test of time, because very rarely, you know, at least in the mainstream radio circles, do you hear a number one hit that's an instrumental track. What does that say to you about how maybe tastes have changed at all, do you think?
Well, I think at the time, that particular sound, the sound of the Hammond M3 organ, was unique. People had heard the B3 organ before, but not very many people were using that little Hammond M3. Ray Charles is the only one I knew that was playing that other than myself. Most Jimmy Smith, all the other organ players were playing the B3 sound with the Leslie speaker. It was a clean, plain, unique little sound.
So you are coming to Vancouver in a couple of weeks. What do you enjoy about playing in this city?
Vancouver's beautiful. Who was I there with? Every time I played there, I've had a good experience, and I've been going there since 1968, and I've had beautiful audiences, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, we are looking forward to you. Booker T. Jones, thank you so much for your time today. This has been a real pleasure.
You're welcome, Dan. Thanks for calling.
Alrighty, cheers. Have a good one.
Okay, you too. Bye.
Claude Morrison, thanks for being here. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I feel welcome.
So, you guys are on your what's been called the Nylons Farewell Tour. Why did it feel like the right time for you guys to do something like that?
Let me see. There's various answers, all of which I'll give you. One of our guys is moving to Australia, so that will make it more difficult for us to get together. It doesn't mean that we're not altogether inaccessible, but it's just sort of less and less likely. We've been going for 37 years, which is a long run by anybody's standards. And speaking for myself, sometimes I feel like the mileage is catching up with my body, if you know what I mean. And since I'm not getting any younger, there are things that I'd like to do in my life while I'm still able to do them. But this has been like a wonderful. Being in the Nylons for the past 37 years, it's been more than a living. It's been a life, and I'm really thankful for that life and for all the opportunities that it's given me. But I think somehow, I don't know, I think all of us are in agreement that, in our guts, it just seems like a good time to wrap it up.
Now you mentioned that you guys have been together for 37 years, and yet you're the only one that, at least that I've read, that has been there for all 37 years.
That's
What is
right.
that like for you? You know, having played with or performed with so many different people throughout those 37 years.
Good question. It's been over the course of the 37 years, there's been a total of 12 people in the Nylons, only ever four at a time. But I guess you might almost say there's a high attrition rate in this group. There's been, I guess, five members who have passed away, regrettably, and that leaves the other seven of us who are still around. And so it's any time that we've had to replace a group member, it's a huge psychic deal. It's like very difficult to do. It's hard. It's hard to choose the newest member. You can tell if somebody can sing, if somebody can dance, but it's harder to know, except on a gut level, whether or not you're even going to be compatible with them, because you're going to be spending a lot of time with them. And it's kind of a bit of a roll of the dice, hold your breath, fingers crossed kind of thing. And I think we've been very fortunate. I suppose our gut instincts have, by and large, have served us well. But I mean, we haven't been there since the beginning. Someone said to me that I would be uniquely qualified to write a book about the Nylons. However, in as much as the people that I would go back farthest with are no longer among us, it would be really difficult for me to, recapture some of those moments, some of the memories that, those seminal experiences that make for good autobiography. And so I just don't know if I could really do a complete job of it. You know, I need somebody around who was there to jog my memory and say, you know, oh, don't you remember this place you played or when this kind of thing happened? And what I should have done, if I had known that we were going to be going for 37 years, I should have kept a journal from the very beginning. But I didn't. And so now I would just sort of be relying on my memory, which can be a little bit dodgy.
When you first started this project, way back when, did you have any inclination that it would be sort of what it became?
No. The short answer to that is no. We were just, you know, kind of flying by the seat of our pants. I mean, we were young, we were carefree. We weren't really thinking that much into the future. We were just four out-of-work actor, singer, dancers who were getting together just for the fun of it and just being creative in between jobs. You know, in theater talk, we would say resting. But in fact, we were unemployed. So we created our own employment, not specifically intending to do that, but somebody heard us and offered us our first gig. Because initially we used to play at parties or fashion shows or benefits, you know, that kind of thing, before we ever had a real first paying job. And somebody was at one of the parties and it so happens I'm opening up a cabaret and I need an act to open it up. So I'll give you a pre-production budget of however much it was, I forget. Get some costumes together, get a few more arrangements together, and you open on the 16th of May. So that gave us a couple of months to get it all together. And a two-week gig turned into a six-week gig. And after those 6 weeks, we moved uptown into a larger venue and played for the next 6 months, ending on New Year's Eve. And that was, you know, how it kind of all began. We immediately sort of took right off and became media darlings here in Toronto. And because everybody just seemed to think it was so outrageous what we were doing. We didn't think it was that outrageous as such. You know, I mean, nobody was killing chickens on stage or anything like that. But I guess nobody had really gone out and flown without a net the way we did. Because you sing an a cappella, so you can't sort of sit back for 16 bars and let the saxophone take over. You're constantly putting out. And I guess that was, in retrospect, I guess that was sort of unusual. Outrageous might be a little bit strong, but yeah, it was unusual. And it's gratifying to know that over the years, I've had so many people come up and say, you know, because of you guys, we started our own a cappella group. And it's nice to know that you had that kind of effect. You don't always realize unless somebody, you know, comes up and taps you on the shoulder and say, hey, you changed my life. And that sort of, you know, makes you proud and humble all at the same time.
You know, there's a lot of a cappella groups out there now. Many are inspired by you. But how do you think that the specific way in which you guys perform, how is that perhaps different than some of the other a cappella groups that are out there?
Well, I think it's relevant that, as I said before, we were in the theater, and so we kind of took that approach to our live shows. And even to the choice of material that we would do. If it would lend itself to an approach on stage, you know, a visual approach, a staging approach, we would do that because, as I said, we were actors. And so we would jazz it up with some theatrics. You know, we weren't just sort of just standing there and you know, sing it down by the old mill stream or anything like that. We would, you know, add choreography, we would add, you know, lighting, and, you know, sort of conceive the number. Each song was kind of like a one-act play. You conceived it and you fleshed it out from a theatrical point of view, and I think that's one of the things that set us apart from others that were starting up maybe at the same time.
Was the barbershop quartet kind of feel always a conscious thing for you guys, or did that just sort of grow with the group?
Well, we never really did Barbershop as it's known. It's one reason why we termed the music rock a cappella, because we saw it as a cross between a cappella, a little bit rock and roll, you know, a little bit R&B, even, you know, some gospel, occasionally some jazz. I just blanked. Where was my train of thought now? As far as Barbershop went, we never really did much of the traditional Barbershop approach, you know, with the stop time and everything like that. Quite the contrary, actually. Our approach was always more driven, more rhythmic. Even if it was only clapping our hands or stomping our feet or snapping our fingers, which later progressed to actual drums, and we had congas on stage. One of our group members was a very good conga player. And so percussion, I think, was another element that a lot of more traditional a cappella groups did not have. But that was always a major orientation for us, was the rhythmic element that just kept it driving, kept it moving forward.
I know for me, when I first discovered you guys, it was because of the song Lion Sleeps Tonight. Why do you think that particular song arguably became your guys' biggest hit?
Well, I think you're right. Certainly in terms of our stage show, it's probably the song that most people came to hear. And so that song has been very, very good to us over the years. And hopefully we've been good to the song. It was, I guess, because there have been many renderings of Lion Sleeps Tonight. It's been recorded often. It's been a hit quite often by various artists. And but I guess it's just something. It's a simple song, really. And I think that's something that maybe the people, you know, gravitated towards, because it's something they could understand. You know, there's nothing really complicated about it. It wasn't any kind of sophisticated arrangement. Quite the contrary. I'll confess this. We kind of stole our arrangement from the Tokens, who had a very big hit with it back in the early 60s, I think it was. And so we modeled our arrangement on the Tokens version, with, you know, some exceptions, and, you know, threw in approaches of our own. But just, I guess the song is something universal about it. Wherever we have gone in the world, people recognize that song. So it's not so much the word famous, the song is famous. And it's been done by many, as I say, by many different artists, and everybody seems to know it. No matter where you go, everybody knows it, which is why in the live show, we do it towards the end, because we're afraid that we did it earlier in the show that everybody would get up and walk out when we've done Lion Sleeps Tonight. So we pretty much invariably save it for the end, just to keep people in their seats and, you know, hold it, you're not going anywhere. They call out for it in the middle of the show. And we said, well, okay, we'll do Lion Sleeps Tonight if you want it now. But, you know, if we do it now, then that's the end of the show. So is that what you want? And then they're like, no, stay. So, we kind of, we always hold it back for the latter part of the show.
I know a couple other of the songs that you guys have been well known for are Shanana, or Hey 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 Goodbye, and Happy Yes. Together by the Turtles. And they both seem to be of a similar era. What is it about, you know, about songs from sort of the, you know, the late 50s and 60s that seems to bode well for you guys as artists?
Well, I think, you know, if you go back to that time, it was kind of a golden age for songwriting. You know, it was out of the Brill Building in New York came many songwriting teams that produced many, many kinds of songs. You know, Carole King and Jerry Groffin, Lieben Staller, the guys who wrote for the Monkees, Tommy Jones and Bobby Hart. It was a golden age of songwriting. And keep in mind that we started in the late 70s. The early 60s was not that long ago. in that context. Now it is that long ago because we're now in, what, 2016. But back in the late 70s, it was fairly recent. The early 60s was, you know, fairly recent, you know, but maybe 15 years old. And those are songs that we kind of grew up on. Our musical influences were anything by the vocal group, whether it be the Bee Gees or the Beatles or Mamas and the Papas, Peter, Paul and Mary, anything by Motown. Those were our mostly our biggest musical influences, I suppose. And so, you know, it being the music that we grew up on, that just naturally found its way into our repertoire.
You mentioned all those people you were influenced by. How does it feel now to be one of the bands or one of the groups that influences singers and bands of a new generation?
Old. I guess. I suppose I would say it's, you know, honored that we've had that kind of an influence. And the more to the point, we've had, you know, such a great ride just to have had this kick up the can and for that to go on, you know, for such a long time. We didn't anticipate how long this was going to last when we started. We didn't know if it was going to last 1 year, if it was going to last 5 years, or if it was going to last 37 years. We just kept doing it because we liked it. And as people came and went within the group, for myself, I guess I was... I wanted it to keep going because I thought, well, where are you going to get another opportunity like this when you get to write your own ticket, you know, do your own show, make your own choices, as opposed to going back to auditioning, putting yourself at the mercy of, you know, whomever, which you may or may not get. This was an opportunity to do what we wanted to do. And that, again, was just something that just took on a life of its own. And we were, you know, really lucky that it had the legs, that it had the staying power that it did.
As we mentioned off the top, this is the farewell tour, the last set of shows. Are these going to be any different than what you guys have done in the past?
Well, I think we'll be adding some material, some of which isn't even on any record. We'll still be working up stuff to offer our audience instead of, you know, only the same old, which they want to come and hear. We'll be doing a broad cross-section of that, but we'll also be putting stuff in the show that we've never done before, either live or on record. So there will be some things that are unfamiliar, but I sort of joke around that this is our first farewell tour. Because there's been, people naturally get very cynical, you know, when you say, oh, farewell tour, yeah, like Cher, like Frank Sinatra. How many times have they said they were retiring? And then, you know, old Blue Eyes came back, and, you know, Cher came back for her third farewell tour concert. So it's kind of been a joke. And as I said at the beginning, it's not inconceivable that we'll get back together and do it again, but it has to be under specific conditions. So we won't be constantly out there on the road from now on. Once upon a time, our manager's instructions, his mandate, was to keep us working. And that's no longer the case. You know, now, because we're getting into our emeritus years, it's a polite way of saying, you know, now that we're getting older, we're more picky and choosy about what we do, where we do it, the circumstances under which we do it. And I suppose, you know, to be perfectly blunt, cost factor. All of that, all of those, and last but not least, our own availability. Because other guys, you know, Garth is moving to Australia. Gavin often does his own concerts with symphony orchestras, you know, all over the place. So it's sometimes difficult for the four of us to get together, just in terms of everybody's, you know, personal life. You know, because everybody has a life, you know, everybody's married and, you know, is off kind of a lot of the time doing their own thing. So, you know, and I find that sort of, don't think this the wrong way, but the less we do it, the more I like it. So less is more, kind of, because we're not seeing each other so often that we're, you know, sick of seeing each other. It's more fun now when we do get together. And I sort of enjoy the shows more because we're not doing it as often, as relentlessly. And so I think that partly keeps it fresh for us. But that's not to say we're going to be disappearing off the face of the earth. I mean, who knows? Maybe there'll be even be another album, you know, down the road. But that remains to be seen. And but no, we are not going to be disappearing off the face of the earth. We'll still be around, but just being more circumspect about what we do and the circumstances under which we do it.
Well, the Nylons are going to be in Vancouver on April 9th. Claude Morrison, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Always enjoy it, and it'll be nice to get back out to Vancouver.
Yeah, we look forward to seeing you here on the West Coast.
Thank you so much.
All right.
We've always gotten such great support on the West Coast, so always happy to go back.
We look forward to having you. Cheers, and we'll see you soon.
Okay, thanks very much.
Alrighty, ciao.
Take care. Bye-bye.
I'm Limerick. Limerick.
Drew used to run the place.
No, I've never met Drew.
And the bouncers were insane. There was like a meth lab above the dressing room.
Oh, yeah?
And all the bouncers were wired.
I'm here with Greg Keeler from Blue Rodeo. Hello, Greg.
How you doing?
Good, how are you doing?
I'm getting there.
Nice to play to... We were just talking about how nice a venue that the Orpheum is here.
Mm-hmm.
What do you like about sort of playing in the older, sort of more opera-style theaters?
You know, it's funny. They're hard rooms to play, you know, because they were designed for a guy standing on stage and singing without amplification. And so they're acoustically delicate. And often these older rooms, you know, the Orpheum or Massey Hall, or there aren't too many across Canada of this vintage. The volume can really overwhelm it. And so you have to be careful that you don't come out blasting too loud or else you sort of overwhelm the room. But it's always nice to look out from the stage because it's such a museum piece, you know.
Does that make it more difficult technical-wise because it's a much more delicate balance with the acoustics?
A little bit. You know, in these old rooms, you know, we'll get into the details a bit. These old rooms are a real pain in the ass for the crew because they weren't constructed with loading docks in the same way that, you know, a lot of the other rooms are, or, you know, we play a lot of arenas too. So there's a certain inconvenience for the crew, and they're sort of mutting around as they're blah, 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 blah. And it's the same at Massey Hall because, you know, Massey Hall is actually doing a renovation right now. They're going to put in a loading dock and make it more convenient for touring acts to get in there. No, these rooms are all just about the architecture of the old room, but they are a bit of a riddle.
You've mentioned the Massey Hall, and of course I know your most recent album was a live album that was recorded at Massey Hall.
Yeah.
Does your guys' recording process change when you're recording it live from a venue as opposed to in studio?
Oh God, yeah, it's quite different. You know, live you just mic everything up and record the night. You know, in the studio, you're like futzing around. You know, you're like, you know, trying little theories of microphone placements and just all the different little things you can do in a studio to enhance the sound and performance. So yes, they're two different things completely.
What was the impetus when you guys said, okay, you know, let's do another live album?
Well, you know, it's not like we're dying to put out another live album, but it's nice to have a record from Massey Hall. I think we have to do two lives for Warner Brothers. So it does that too. And we didn't have a new record ready, so it's a little bit of a bridge of, you know, over the time until we finish. When we finish this tour, we'll go back and make a new record.
I know your last non-live album, I believe, came out in 2014?
That sounds about right.
Is that right?
Yeah.
What
overall, you know, as a band, because you and Jim have been together for so long now.
We met in high school.
Yeah. Do you guys still have a very fluid writing process, or is it pretty refined now after all these years?
Well, we don't write together anymore. Like when we first started, way back when, we didn't really know how to write songs, and so we would just sort of listen to records that we really liked and sort of steal stuff a bit, you know. And then we'd get together and we'd start jamming the pieces together that we had collected, and those would become our songs. It was a band called the High Fives, and I think we started in 78. And we just loved it, you know, the process of whatever that was, writing songs. And we loved singing together. Like, you know, it happened so easily and quickly, you know. It was just a natural fit for our two voices. And so that always got us high. And so we would just keep on writing and writing and writing and writing. And then eventually we sort of learned how to write a song on our own. And then we didn't want each other's involvement in our songs. You know, like, I didn't want his input and he didn't want mine. He just wanted to write his songs. And I can understand that completely because I was feeling the same way. And now, you know, we write our own songs, and, you know, and everyone sort of contributes in the arrangements. You know, when you play in a band, for the most part, you got to just give the song over to the band. And as a songwriter, you sort of get the last say. You sort of you get the veto, you know, as the songwriter, if something isn't working out the way you like it. You know, because sometimes, you know, you'll have a pretty clear picture in your head of how the song should sound. And then other times you just want to see how everyone plays it and how it turns out.
And now I know you guys have added a few new members over the years. I know Colin, I think, came aboard a couple years ago.
Yeah.
Has that changed the dynamic at all for you guys, having, you know, fresher faces, you know, people playing the same instruments but differently than you guys? Has that altered maybe the state of the band at all?
Well, that's a good point, you know. Like, I think, yeah. Like, when I think of the first band with Cleve Anderson on drums and Bobby Wiseman on keyboards, you know, that was quite a different band, and Bobby was an incredible keyboard player and quite avant-garde and experimental. And so that band had a, you know, a certain energy. And then the next band was a great band with Kim Deschamps on pedal steel and James Gray on keyboards, and that was the Five Days band, and that was really a great band. Then who left? Then we got a new drummer, and then he left. Got another new drummer, Glenn Milcham, who's been in the band. He's the new guy. I think he's been in the band about 20 years. And that really changed the sound of the band. James Gray left. We got Michael Boguski there now. That really changes the color. And then my ears got really burnt out. And I can't really play electric guitar on stage anymore. So we got Colin Cripps on guitar. And that really changes the sound of the band. So the evolution, at times, you know, difficult. You know, you feel a little lost when you lose somebody. But for the most part, it's always, well, I would say no, not even for the most part, it's always turned out, you know, to make the band interesting and sort of new again.
You mentioned Bob Wiseman, and if I remember correctly, wasn't it him, you and Jim went to New York, and is that where you hooked up with, was it Bob you hooked up with there?
We knew his elder brother there, and he was a fledgling screenwriter. And I lived in his apartment for, I guess, about half a year. And he had a house in Toronto. And when I moved back to Toronto, I stayed at that house, and Bobby was living in that house. And so it was quite remarkable. You know, he said, I'm a keyboard player. Oh, I play guitar and I write songs. And so I said, well, let's jam. And so I remember I had just written Rose Colored Glasses, and I played it. And, you know, did the verse and the chorus a couple of times, and he was just playing piano. And then when it got to the solo, he just went over the edge into, like, Cecil Taylor land. And I'd never played with anybody like that. You know, I'd listened to some avant-garde sort of stuff, and dissonant sort of things. But I thought it was so exciting and beautiful. I thought, you join our band? And he had an old Ace tone in the basement that he never played, but it's a beautiful, it's like a Farfisa, you know, it's a really cool old keyboard. And he brought that out, and he came to rehearsal, and we were totally infatuated.
You guys, as Blue Rodeo, I think you released your first album in 1987. How have you found, how much has the industry changed for you since then? How much easier or harder is it to actually make music?
Well, it's easier to make music now. You know, it's easier for people to record. Anyone can make a quality recording, you know, sitting in their bedroom. And so there's so many records made nowadays. And that's good. You know, people making records it's a great process. It's a great art of discovery and collaboration and all that sort of stuff. You know, it's really... But how do you make money nowadays making records? You know, which is what I wanted to do. I wanted to make records and I wanted to make a living. So it's a lot harder now. And it, in my time, there was a culture of people going out to bars and seeing bands when we first started. That's what my generation sort of did. We went to bars and watched bands and we bought records, you know, and eventually, you know, cassettes and CDs. But we were consumers of product and we liked having the thing. And so I think it's harder to make a living at it now. I think that there's a great democratization, if that's a word, of it. Because anybody can make a record now, and that's good. But, you know, I understood the system of having to make a career out of it better than I do now. So I'm happy I'm at this point in my career, you know, the tail end, rather than just starting out, because I'd be a little lost right now.
And finally, is there one piece of advice you would give to maybe young, aspiring musicians or songwriters trying to break into the business?
Well, I know when I was young, I couldn't listen to anyone's advice, and I sort of had my way to do it. And people would give me advice, and I'd say, what? Yeah. And actually, there were a few people. I can think of some people that I really respected, and so, you know, it always felt nice. But I guess I should have some sort of stock answer for this. But as cliched as it is, just, you know, do the things you believe in and stay with that. And don't listen to the advice and promises of others who want you to change so that you could be a success. But don't listen to me.
Wise words. Hey, Greg Keeler, thanks so much for doing this, man.
Thank you very much.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you very much.